Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have special pleasure in talking to Camille Paglia, who is in Philadelphia. We're going to be talking about her new book, Break, Blow, Burn. It's published by Pantheon. It's her reading of 43 of the world's best poems, and consistent with it is the assertion that poems can still be read, that in some crazy lapse, people have started doing other things with poetry, theorizing about it, doing everything but the thing that we did know was successful, that you could read them line by line and perform explication of the text. Now, Camille, these poems and these explications have stood the test of the classroom and a very diligent and demanding students, sometimes night students, as I recall.
That's right. This book is the result of my some 34 now years of classroom teaching and the enormous range of students that I've had. I haven't just taught at elite schools, but also at community colleges and night classes and a helicopter factory and, in Connecticut when I was trying to finish my first book, Sexual Personae. And so I have, I think, a good sense of the general audience in ways maybe that people who teach for the creme de la creme don't have.
You suggest, in fact, that all over the country, it's the people who are teaching in community colleges and who are not teaching the so-called elite who are keeping literature alive. Can you explain that?
Well, in the 1970s, there was an influx of post-structuralism from Europe that I think totally threw the humanities off track and has diminished the prestige of literature departments and of poetry generally since. The theorists were interested in doing theory, not in engaging directly with works of art, whether literary or visual. I believe, as a product of the 1960s, in subordinating myself to art, not in lording over it and dictating to it with a laundry list of demands and complaints.
Well, I think you and I also both had the benefit of what was there for us in the 60s, that is to say the presence, the catalyzing presence of extraordinary teachers. For me, those were Hugh Kenner and the dear departed Leslie Fiedler, both of them dear departed. You too had extraordinary teachers animating the process of hearing and feeling and breathing a poem.
Yes, I was at the State University of New York at Binghamton, where I had a wonderful education in literature from the poet Milton Kessler, who had studied with Theodore Rethke at the University of Washington. And, of course, at the State University of New York in Buffalo at that very moment was Leslie Fiedler, who was an enormous icon to us in the 60s. And both Fiedler and Kessler were images of engagement with politics, with passion, with showing themselves, with an openness toward emotion that I think is totally missing from post-structuralists and postmodernists who are addicted to a kind of callow, whimsical irony.
Now, I think also necessary is that we describe our homes, because I know that you grew up in Endicott. I grew up in Bayside, Queens. Neither of our families were literary, and yet the exposure to something that took us outside the home, I mean outside the home in the largest sense, to a sense of culture, and to the idea that that was ours, that world of culture, in a way that we were heir to nothing else, that if there were no great monetary or economic inheritance, we had the inheritance of our various cultures, and that was what we were in the state universities finding, that even though we came from places that might have been poor, that our education could be very rich.
Yes, I'm the product of an Italian immigrant family. All four of my grandparents and my mother were born in Italy. They came to upstate New York to work in the Endicott Johnson shoe factories. My father, though, was the first of a family of 10 to go to college on the GI Bill after World War I. He went to a community college, which then became, later on, the State University of New York at Binghamton that I attended. And then my father, after I was born, became a high school teacher, taught actually French and Spanish, then went back to graduate school, and finally ended up teaching at a Jesuit school in Syracuse, Le Moyne College, for most of his career. So I did have that example of a kind of dissident himself.
Now, you've chosen 43 poems, which you call the world's best poems, among the world's best poems, for Break, Blow, Burn. What, first of all, can a poem do? It took me, and I've been honest on the air about this. Poetry was the last of the verbal art forms to open to me. And when a poem first happened to me, I have to say, it came with a physical response. That is to say, if you've just been reading them and nothing has happened to you, you haven't had one happen to you yet. But I promise you that when it does happen, you will recognize it and remember it, and it will start to happen again and again. Now, what is it, do you think, now, today, that readers can come to poetry without teachers?
Oh, yes, I certainly do. I believe that art belongs to the general audience, that no mediation is necessary. All you need is some encouragement, a sense of confidence, and also a confidence in your own sense of instinct. I think that too few people follow instinct today. Now, I do feel that what you have just said is very close to my theory of poetry, which is that poetry is not philosophy. That is, poetry uses language that that subliminally manipulates our nerve impulses and appeals to our senses. So there's something pre-rational or irrational about the way that poetry leads us to perception. And that's also what's missing from contemporary theory in the academy. The sense of the natural, of our biological, our physiological forces, the things which cannot perhaps be totally verbalized, that is completely missing from post-structuralism, because post-structuralism denies that nature exists. But for me, poetry is almost the connection between the mind and body, the mind and nature.
I don't think post-structuralism is the only problem, Camille. I remember that when I was a boy, if I went into a bookstore, I met so many people who were in love with poetry. They may not love their jobs. They didn't love their jobs. They were being paid what then passed for minimum wage. But there were so many educated people working in bookstores who could tell me what to read next. And I think that part of what people are dealing with is that constant pounding, not just of choices of things to read, but all the things that they're hearing and seeing around them. And so the finding of a kindred spirit, a soulmate in a bookstore who says, oh, read this, you'll never be the same afterwards. People are not having that as a daily experience in their life, someone to take them by the hand and guide them. That's why I think your book is like the finding of a superior friend.
Well, part of the problem over the last decade, of course, is the sinking into bankruptcy often of these independent bookstores with a knowledgeable staff. We're in the period now of the great chain bookstores, of course, with people have access certainly to the web with all of its manifold forms of information. But that kind of the guidance one used to get from the shrewd, knowledgeable bookman, okay, or bookwoman. I think that experience is gone. So yes, what I've tried to provide is a chronological, orderly opening, introduction to the history of poetry in English. My original desire was to include translations from other languages, but I just felt that was becoming cumbersome. So I have simply traced a line of often mutual influence from poems from William Shakespeare all the way down to the present. And the book ends with Joni Mitchell's Woodstock, which I consider the greatest poem written in English by man or woman after Sylvia Plath's Daddy.
Now, there are certain poems that you read, especially Daddy, where the reading process becomes animated and vociferous. I think of Camille Paglia's book, Sexual Personae, as one of those books where the passion becomes so heated that the author is talking directly to you. She's talking to you sometimes in the valuable language that you don't understand. For instance, I could never have anticipated the words she uses to describe the figures of Aubrey Beardsley. It's one of my favorite paragraphs in the book. She notices that they're half insect, half carapace, and all kinds of words enter the field of the criticism. That is to say that the criticism is asking you to do what literary art does, to fall in love with language. How important is the language of criticism, the language you write when you're reading a poem, to your process of reading?
Well, for me, it's all important, and I have tried to appeal to the profession to change its ways. I think, quite frankly, that I succeeded when I burst on the scene with Sexual Personae in 1990. It was the first breakout book, you know, from academic press into general media attention. And at the time, editors told me how difficult it was for them to argue with professors who wanted to write in this very jargon-choked way, saying, oh, what we're saying is so important. But the editors felt they had no credentials for arguing with that. And my point from the moment I came on the scene was all literary criticism should be accessible to the general reader. And I think you can see that step by step the profession is starting to fall in line. You see it at the highest levels of American academe as people are purging their prose of false difficulty and really trying to find the general reader. Now, in this particular book, it took me 5 years to write. Actually, the last 2 years were spent only on the prose, only on that, in a way that is just mad, you know, in this day and age.
By the way, I'm speaking with Camille Paglia. She's in a studio in Philadelphia. I'm here at KCRW in Los Angeles. We're talking about Break, Blow, Burn, the book of readings of 43 great poems published by Pantheon by my guest, Camille Paglia. Throughout the book, Camille Paglia mentions, for instance, in an Emily Dickinson poem, that the original second stanza had not been as powerful as what she was to write 4 years later. Let's remember that those 8 lines, 10 lines, 12, sometimes are the product of accretions and contractions that go on over 10, 12 years. This is a birth progress of staggering difficulty leading to a moment of immediacy.
Yes, and I must say that in the process of doing the book, I had a number of surprises myself. The original proposal for Break, Blow, Burn had on the list of prospective poets to include all of the leading names of our time. But when I got actually into the contemporary decades of the last 30 years, I was shocked to find that the poems by the leading poets, the most honored, revered poets of our time, did not hold up to the fantastic masterpieces that preceded in the book, from Shakespeare through John Donne through William Blake and Wordsworth and Yeats and so on. And I've ended up in the contemporary writers with a number of poets that many people will not recognize. I made judgments only on the basis of the poem. I became so impatient going through anthologies and through the collected works of all the famous poets of the last 30 years, how so many poems were just let go and put into print before they were ready. There's been far too much impatience, I think, with the individual poem, a lack of a sense of craft.
Now, I think that a certain amount of crazy and passionate inaccessibility is important to let people know that there's a whole path. If you want to go further with this, there is a vastness beyond belief, an open field to be encountered and explored. So I feel a little bit nervous about the idea that all criticism should be accessible to the general reader. Do you really feel that that's true?
I think that the criticism should always point you back toward the original. You should be going, look at this. Look what you never noticed. Look how I respond to it. You too could respond to this. I don't expect my readers to agree with me about anything. I just want to bring them to a higher level of perception, to just like sort of blow out the jams and make them look at familiar works, let's say, like the Mona Lisa in Sexual Persona, in a new way. I think that's all that a critic can aim to do. Again, the problem with criticism in this era of the theorists of the last 30 years is that it talks down condescendingly to literature. It says that somehow the critic has a higher knowledge than the artist, which I do not believe.
But I'm talking about the poet who, for instance, one of the poets who's noticeably not here is John Ashbery. I would suggest that in his wildness, in the incomprehensibility of what he brings together, he's like Coleridge at the end of Kubla Khan, that he stands as a figure whose the vastness of whose complex incomprehension leads us to a veneration for the artist. And I wondered about the absence of the so-called difficult unto insanity poem.
The problem for me with Ashbery, when I actually reviewed his work for inclusion in this book, I fully expected him to be here, was that I found the language affected. I found it academic. I found a certain type of self-consciousness and a talking to to critics, not even to other poets, but to critics, a too obvious sense of status and trying to place himself in regard to the contemporary hierarchy, of culture. I feel like he never really lets himself go or uses language that I think still has authenticity. I feel that English or American English has changed radically over the past 30 years because of the dominance of popular culture. I mean, it's practically changed decade by decade. I listen to a lot of talk radio. I watch a lot of TV. I listen to popular music and so on. So when I'm judging the language of Ashbery, I'm saying this is not a living language. This is a kind of Alexandrian style that I cannot put in this book because I cannot endorse it for the general reader. Now, I respect Ashbery, of course. I respect all of the major poets of our time. They are they're erudite. They're engaged. They're brilliant. But I am judging in this book, in Break the Little Burn, by the individual artifact. Has this poet created a poem that will last? John Ashbery, I'm sorry to say, for all of his gifts, his genius, has not produced the poem that will last.
Now we have five poets, I think six perhaps, living, who are in the last section of the book. Those are Gary Snyder, Norman H. Russell, Chuck Wachtel, Rochelle Kraut, Wanda Coleman. Ralph Pomeroy died. Joni Mitchell is not officially known as a poet. Now, for most people, of those, Gary Snyder might be the only poet they know. How does a poem last in the absence of a knowledge of the poet by the popular audience?
Well, in plowing through all of these anthologies and collections that I did in preparation for the book, gathering material, I went through anthologies from the early 19th century on. I was looking for the poem and not, the name of the poet. So I do believe that a poem will suddenly leap out at you, perhaps for personal reasons. But I was trying for this book, to make judgments that I feel are aesthetic ones. That is, is this poem able to last aside from your knowledge of who has written it? in the kind of line-by-line explication in the classroom, the kind of microscopic attention and pressure that we bring to bear on a great Shakespeare sonnet or the great poems of Coleridge and Blake and Yeats. And that was the standard I used. I'm as surprised as anyone by the results of this in my book.
I noticed that many of the poems, but particularly of the modern poems, are on the subject of dealing with terrifying authority. The tornado, natural authority, a paragraph, the authority of the media and its dead languages, Wanda Coleman's poem about the ways in which hectorers attempt to undermine the self, and, of course, the Ralph Pomeroy poem, which is about a silent encounter with a policeman. And it struck me as interesting and of our time that we no longer know how to even look authority in the eye. And it seemed pertinent that these poems should be about the confrontation with the overwhelming, or even simply the culturally threatening.
Well, yes, I love what you're saying. Of course, the poem about the tornado, however, is about the natural force so enormous that it obliterates any sense of shape, form, or identity. This has been one of the big themes of my work since the very first page of Sexual Personae. I say in the beginning was nature, and that civilization is a very frail structure erected on this thin skin of the globe upon which we huddle. And I think that the academic theory has, in its rabid social constructionism, has denied the enormous power of nature over us, which the giant tsunamis of December, I think, have brought forcibly to public attention. Far greater than any society, far greater than any political authority, is this the brutality of natural process.
And does a poet take that brutality into himself in order to represent it, or is it the awe and powerlessness from which he works, do you think?
Well, I have a huge range here of poets in terms of their response to cosmic realities. There is religious poetry here. I am an atheist, a lapsed Catholic, but I believe that religion is a great symbol system, and that is far more sustaining than any of these academic theories of our time. So we find in John Donne, from which the title Break, Blow, Burn comes in the first place, in George Herbert's poems, you find an engagement with God, a sense of God as a transcendent being. When we get to Wordsworth in the book, it's clear that for Wordsworth, the divine is immanent in nature, so diffusing nature, and for Wordsworth, salvation is these moments of intensified consciousness. And then we go on to these other formulations. Emily Dickinson is questioning the existence of God, and what some of the most powerful lines in her have to do with the coldness of an intergalactic skyscape that I believe she was the first to see. It actually predates the invention of modern science fiction as a genre. And then we go on to Rethke and his sense of the muse, of this very seductive female figure that seems to be coming out of the mist and the water, but probably is his own anima in the Jungian sense, coming from deep within. And then the tornado, which we have this poem by Norman Russell, which I think speaks to American culture. I think it's one of the big aspects of American society that is ignored by European commentators. That is our confrontation here with great hurricanes and tornadoes and the great swatch of the Grand Canyon that is a living book of geological time. Europe is very small and parochial, and its weather systems are quite mild in in their range compared to us. So I think that the American sublime is one of the great themes of my book as well. I do feel, yes, that the poet has the ability to think cosmically, okay, and to relate the self to the vast metaphysics, okay, but again, keying it to the language of the body.
I remember that Flannery O'Connor, writing to someone who'd written an essay about her, said, "Your idea of the devil seems to be mine of God." It's one of my favorite sentences. In this book, Break, Blow, Burn, these are the things that John Donne asks God to do to, in a sense, perfect him, make him worthy, purify him. It seems that Break, Blow, Burn is what you would ask Ark to do in the absence of God. Is there an accuracy in that?
That's absolutely true. I follow a kind of religion of art. My apostle for this was Oscar Wilde, whose witticisms I found in a secondhand book as an adolescent in Syracuse. I became converted to his worldview. There's no doubt that for me, art is a substitute for religion. That I feel that art has a spiritual but not a moral dimension. I feel that especially following the Industrial Revolution, when middle class people are trapped in routine and in offices and drowning in paperwork and so on, that we need a reactivation of language, a re-energizing of perception, and therefore art has played, since Romanticism, a greater and greater role, or should. When parents are paying through the nose to send their kids to school, to college these days, obviously the parents are expecting that their students will be trained in the humanities, will be the whole door of the paradise of the humanities will be open to them, but that's not what they're getting. What I'm trying to do here is to get back to basics and to do the critic's job, which is to say, this is the best, or these are the texts that have worked for me, or that have worked for my classes for so many decades. And it's a question of quality control, but our current academe does not want to speak in terms of quality. Quality is something that has a hidden bias, a hidden agenda, that's all about power, it's all about ideology. Oh, what nonsense. Absolute nonsense. The people in academe at the very highest level now in the humanities are Philistines. Philistines and ignoramuses.
I've been speaking with Camille Paglia, author most recently of Break, Blow, Burn. It's in the book, Camille Paglia reads 43 of the world's best poems, proving in the process that you can still read a poem. The book is published by Pantheon in hardcover. Thank you, Camille, for joining me.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. Special thanks today to Bob Purdick in Philadelphia at radio station WHYY. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.